Stalin is still popular, even now that we know all the atrocities that happened.
It was a very unfair society. There were stores which had practically nothing.
The Soviet system tried to eliminate anyone who was different.
Russia was a very closed society in those days.
Gorbachev himself was very enthusiastic about destroying the past, but they did not understand what they're supposed to create.
More shocking was the idea that the Communist Party could be dissolved or mightn't be the ruling force.
How often do you get to live in a world in which the country you were born in really doesn't exist anymore?
Death of an Empire.
I'm back in Moscow, here on Taganskaya Square. It's a part of town where I lived in my early days as the Irish Times correspondent here. And I was here in January 1992. I remember the start of that year, the Soviet Union and Mikhail Gorbachev were gone. Boris Yeltsin was the leader of a new state, the Russian Federation, and Yeltsin's team attempted to shift the economy from a controlled state economy to a free market one overnight. Prices were liberalised, inflation rocketed. It hit a peak of nearly 2,500% by later that year. People's savings and pensions were wiped out, and many were forced to sell their belongings on the street, basically to get enough money for food. When Boris Yeltsin visited an open market in St. Petersburg with empty stalls, he met customers who were perplexed and confused. Russia was in a bad way, and the West was prepared to help. The Americans flew in plane loads of aid. European Community, including Ireland, sent even more significant aid. In fact, the EC sent 15,000 tons of beef alone, and 2,300 tons of this came in the first shipment from Ireland. But the Russian mafia was already beginning to form. 8 tons of Irish butter were stolen in St. Petersburg, and I saw cans of Northern Ireland beef, marked as humanitarian aid, on sale on the black market in a Moscow street. So the European Community then sent a military team to protect the goods. One of those was Mark Hearns from Ireland, who met and married Olga Artemova, who was working at the Arenta supermarket, the Irish House, in downtown Moscow.
There was a food aid sent by Europe. I think it was butter, meat and powdered milk. And that was the way European Union wanted to help the country to go through the difficult times, basically, that there was no social unrest because of the shortage of food. That was only one of the tough years. I think all the 90s were very, very tough. The country went through very dark times, really dark times.
Olga recalls how she was paid in rubles. But when the ruble collapsed, her salary was paid in vouchers. 1992 marks the beginning, as Olga says, of a very dark period for Russia.
When the collapse of the Soviet Union happened, there was a huge boost of uncertainty.
Konstantin Gurdjieff.
People all of a sudden lost jobs, and that was for the first time. Not only they lost jobs, in many cases they've lost pay while keeping the jobs. So in other words, they were showing up for work, but there was no work to do. So nominally they were employed at the factories, but they were not collecting wages. In many cases, wages were held back by there was a whole criminal underpayment of wages, whereby the bosses would take the wages transmitted by the state into the factory, park it for 3 months, collect the interest on it, and then release them. So there was a huge non-payment system. And that had a psychological impact. At the same time, also, of course, pensions were not paid out. So you all of a sudden saw a wave, huge wave of pensioners carrying out their little bits of savings or things that they accumulated over a lifetime, few antiques maybe, few heirlooms passed over generations. They brought them into the streets and started selling them.
This inflation, it was unbelievable, unbelievable. I couldn't even afford a bar of chocolate for a child. The bars of chocolate really were very expensive for those who were receiving the Soviet salaries.
Nola Fomienko was a working mother whose husband had left her, and she was taking care of her daughter Anya, then 7 years old. And Nola had a good job by Russian standards. She was an editor in a Moscow publishing house.
In our publishing house, there were no wage arrears, but in many other places, there people didn't get salary at all. And that time, I remember, old men appeared in the street who were asking for some cash to buy bread. It was the atmosphere of insecurity. It was such a feeling that you were surrounded by criminals.
Nona recalls that a pair of shoes, ordinary shoes, cost 10 times her monthly salary.
There was also the time of the humanitarian aid in schools, and some food was given to children. And we used this food, we took it, brought it home, and cooking it. People took it because it was a matter of absolute surviving.
Kathy Lally, the bureau chief of the Washington Post, was, like me, living in Moscow at the time, covering the story.
It was difficult to watch because as foreigners, we were living on a dollar income, we were shielded. But it was very, very difficult for Russians. And you would see elderly women out on the winter streets holding up a pair of boots, a couple of beautiful little teacups, anything that they had that they could sell and buy a loaf of bread and a little food with. People couldn't understand what had happened. They had gone from being told that they lived in this powerful empire to living in a country where they couldn't afford to buy bread.
But while some Russians were made destitute, others became extremely wealthy, creating a new flashy elite, the new Russians, the Novi Ruski.
When we first arrived, there were very, very few foreign cars on the road. All of a sudden, there were imported cars that were being driven. There were fancy stores selling fancy jewelry, and it just turned into a huge have and have not kind of breach.
So how, when the country was impoverished, did so many get rich? Well, there was a scheme called Loans for Shares, in which selected people were given state loans to buy shares in state resources. Konstantin Gurdjieff traces the emergence of a new class, the oligarchs.
The Communist Party elites recognized that that was their last chance of securing their positions. So they took any sort of the Communist Party property, from buildings all the way to publishing houses and onwards, and they privatized them effectively through the joint ventures with the foreign companies. Then they shared the foreign partners and continued on as the private enterprises. By about mid-1990s, you had not just oligarchs, but the entire business elite of Russia has became this mixture of the small number of the former black marketeers and private enterprise operators in the black market and existent elites. And all of that was ring-fenced by a combination of the power structures of mafia and increasingly the state itself as well, because the state had to compete with mafia, literally, for the imposition of law and order.
For the Irish doing business in Russia, the 1990s presented opportunities, more freedom to travel, ability to take an apartment and open businesses.
Finally, McDonald's threw open the doors to its first restaurant in Moscow.
McDonald's opened in January 1990, and Irish businessman Mike Edgeworth remembers using it in the 90s as an economic indicator.
Not only did we use it in order to be able to sample some Western food from time to time, however bad it might have been, we also used it on a daily basis to determine the value of the ruble. Because as you were travelling into work, you could determine how much the ruble had fallen, depending on the length of the queue at McDonald's. Because if it had fallen sufficiently, there was no queue, because they couldn't afford them anymore. And then, little by little, over the next week or two, the queue would start to form again. So it was a reflection of the spending power of the local Russian people in terms of the value of the ruble in their pocket.
Maria Kernan was working in Moscow as an architect and flying back and forth to Dublin. The road from the airport began, for her, to mark the changes because it became brighter each time, not from streetlights, but from neon advertisements.
There was no advertising at the start. And then every time you came over from the mid-90s, the posters seemed to be getting closer and closer and closer, as though you were going fast forward and speeding up. And the same within the city. The lovely buildings started to be crowded by what I call the noise of advertising. And there was this visual invasion.
For Maria, like many others living in Moscow, it was a world of extremes. There were shops without basics like soap, and then you could go into someone's office and find it stuffed with electrical white goods.
They knew their currency was devaluing and wasn't worth having, so they would buy goods. And commodities were a fairly new idea there for them, and most people didn't have them. So that was the thing of value.
While Boris Yeltsin had been the apparent hero of the 1991 coup, his presidency was overshadowed by his personality and his growing alcoholism. In the beginning, Konstantin Gurdjieff was a supporter of Yeltsin, but things changed. Yeltsin proved unable to lead the country in the chaos of the 1990s.
He always acted as a kind of a loner. That worked at the points where there is a well-defined challenge, which is very short-term. And Yeltsin really was a shining example of a politician who can do that. After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the problems faced by Yeltsin and his administration were entirely different. They were the problems of building. They were the problems of the consistent, sustained effort of creating institutions and then running those institutions. Different character required for it, a person who is a team builder. Yeltsin was terrible at that. And this is where his, I think, failure is. I think the drink is the outcome of the fact that he gave up at a certain point in time. But he was not suited as a leader for the process of consistent, long-term building up of the structure of the state and the economy. He was too much of a maverick. He was too much of a person who would be trying to seize on the immediate opportunity, push it through, get out there, draw the crowds, engage people. That's not what was needed.
Boris Nemtsov was a close ally of Yeltsin, but he too saw the man change.
Well, first of all, he disappeared. He spent a lot of time in Sochi with his friends, drank, relaxed, etc. And Russia lost a lot of time. Economic situation in the country was like a disaster. Russia faced real, absolutely empty stores, empty cafe, nothing. And Yeltsin dramatically lost popularity in few months.
It wasn't long before differences sprang up between President Yeltsin, his Vice President Alexander Rutskoy, and the Speaker of Parliament Ruslan Khasbolatov.
Boris Yeltsin implicitly acknowledged that he is breaking the Russian constitution.
And in September, Yeltsin dissolved the parliament.
He appealed for understanding from the West.
Khasbolatov called the action criminal and called for a workers' strike.
I request you should in no way obey the criminal orders coming from this presidential decree.
Then from behind the scenes emerged Anatoly Lukyanov, the man many believed was the prime mover in the coup against Gorbachev in 1991. Now he was moving against Yeltsin.
Rutskoy went to the parliamentary chamber and took the oath of office.
The parliament elected a new president, Alexander Rutskoy.
Russia tonight has two men claiming to be president.
Yeltsin then sent in the tanks. They shelled the parliament building. Here, and at the TV station in Ostankino, gun battles raged. Hundreds were killed, including TV cameraman Rory Peck from Derry. Edward Limonov was head of the National Bolshevik Party at this time.
Yeltsin troops started to fire from the building. The journalists were first who been killed. I immediately fell on the ground, and then I turn around. I see there some people screaming and some don't moving. I saw about 20 corpses.
Mike Edgeworth was working in the Irish House, the retail business run by Air Rianta at the time.
We were at work that morning, and as we were at work, the tanks were passing by the window. And in fact, we were interviewing people for jobs. We were expanding at the time. And one of the things that we always talk about is that despite the fact this was all over the news media and television and so on, all the Russians that we had lined up for interview turned in for interview and walked past the tanks on the street. And we interviewed them in the building after the shelling commenced. And the building was actually vibrating because we were a short distance from the White House. And I remember in the afternoon, we, out of curiosity and maybe a little bit foolhardy at this stage, decided to make our way down one of the back streets towards the White House to see what was really going on. And there were tracer bullets in the air overhead us. And as we got closer to it, the shelling was in full swing and the two top floors of the White House were on fire. When I came close to the White House, over on the far side of the street, there was a building which was about 16 floors. And on the very top of the floor, there were snipers who were firing onto the backs of the guys in the tanks. So this was a huge threat to the guys in the tanks because the guys in the tanks were facing the White House. So it appeared to me that the order must have come from the military, that one of the tanks just turned around, came up the street on the white line as far as the building, rotated the turret, pointed it to the top floor of the building, blew the top floor off the building, rotated the turret back again and drove back down to the White House.
Russians were now seeing Yeltsin in a new light. The unrest was followed by a referendum for a new constitution, giving Yeltsin and his successors in the Kremlin unprecedented powers to rule by decree. For many of us covering Russia, the events of 93 were a turning point for Yeltsin. While he won the day in terms of holding power, his public standing was altered forever.
Well, I think a lot of people couldn't forgive him for 1993, for seeing the Russian White House turned black from fire.
Sofia Kishkovsky.
I remember someone telling me that she drove by in the trolley bus and saw it, and she said she just can't forgive that image.
While Russian society was in chaos, economically and socially, the added dimension of open warfare in Chechnya, twice in the 1990s, further compounded the turmoil for Russia's fragile democracy.
The Russians had chosen New Year's Eve, while the world is celebrating, to begin their final push for the Chechen capital with a massive and sustained artillery attack.
For Kathy Lally, the beginning of the end for Yeltsin was the October 93 events, followed closely by the horrors of the Chechen wars.
Instead of trying to negotiate with a separatist movement in Chechnya, Yeltsin went in again with tanks firing and really alienated people there, brutalized both sides, the soldiers and the Chechen rebels, and killed many, many innocent bystanders. I was interviewing soldiers' mothers, and I was sitting in the office in downtown Moscow talking to one woman, and she told me that she had just returned from Chechnya and brought her son back with her. And I was almost speechless. I couldn't believe it. And she said she wasn't the only one. And she described to me how Chechen women would help the Russian mothers because they sympathized with them as women living in Russia and as mothers. But it was extraordinary. They would go down there and find their sons on the battlefield and bring them home. And then the soldiers' mother group would try to provide legal advice and see if they could keep them from being thrown in jail.
Yeltsin's plane was already an hour late when it arrived at Shannon Airport, bringing...
By the early 1990s, Boris Yeltsin was increasingly making headlines for his bizarre behaviour and drunkenness. During a stopover in Shannon in September 1994, the Taoiseach Albert Reynolds was left waiting on the red carpet.
President Yeltsin was indisposed. It was an explanation Mr. Reynolds accepted.
Oh, he's very ill after the long travelling. He has his blood pressure going up and down. It's understandable.
Vasily Istratov is a cultural leader, historian and former diplomat.
Well, his non-appearance at Shannon is, of course, one thing which will be remembered for decades. A funny recollection now. I was chargé d'affaires in Dublin in 2001, when the former Soviet President Gorbachev arrived there to receive the freedom of the city of Dublin. And the Lord Mayor took him to his constituency just to show him to the people. And I remember two old ladies communicating with each other, yes, who is that? Oh, that the guy who never showed up in Shannon. So they mixed them up, obviously. So we were ready by that time to be ashamed by our president.
Now, for the first time, I can tell you that you're a disaster.
In a formal visit to Washington in 1995, when Secret Service men picked him up on Pennsylvania Avenue wearing only his underwear and trying to hail a taxi, in a press conference with Bill Clinton, Clinton actually cracked up laughing at Yeltsin's performance.
Великая терпимость Ельцина к журналистам.
Vitaly Abramov is the former editor-in-chief of Izvestia. Yeltsin's period, he says, opened up media freedom, but the price was that in the absence of regulation, the media became too close to big business, and big business was supporting Yeltsin.
Поэтому журналисты взяли на себя функции.
Yeltsin struggled to win the 1996 presidential election, beating the communist candidate Gennady Zyuganov in the second round.
With most of the votes counted, Mr. Yeltsin has an unassailable 13% lead over his communist rival Gennady Zyuganov.
At this time, I experienced what was the most uncanny event of my 50 years in journalism. Myself and Robin Dixon of the Sydney Morning Herald spoke to a man who was close to the security services. He told us there were people who wanted to stop the 96 presidential election. There would be a bomb in the metro, he said. And then, he added, President Yeltsin will become seriously ill. When I got back to my flat after meeting this man, the phone was ringing. It was Robin. There has been a bomb on the metro. Later, in the final week of the campaign, Yeltsin had a massive heart attack.
His aides are saying, are maintaining that he just has a cold and that laid him up for more than 6 days.
The 1996 election highlighted one of the many challenges facing Russia as it emerged from a one-party centralised system and attempted to adapt to a democratic model. Ronan Murphy was Irish ambassador in Moscow from 1995 to 1999.
I believe that the Western countries were probably wrong in trying to make Russia exactly like, or thinking that it could be, a reflection of what we have over here in Europe or in America. Russia is Russia. It is quite different. Countries like Poland and the Czech Republic embraced all of that and became democratic countries. And there is democracy in Russia, but it is a special kind of country. Democracy was not popular. It was seen as weak somehow.
I asked Ron Hill, who has been visiting Russia since the 60s, how Russians began to use the word democrat as an insult. In his view, the experience of the 90s, the Yeltsin years, and the shock economic therapy turned people against Western capitalist democracy.
I think the experience confirmed all that they'd been taught about what capitalism is like, rapacious, and what democracy is like, bourgeois democracy. It is for the rich. People, we're being told by Yeltsin that what they devoted 60 years of their lives to was a mistake. Now, that is demoralizing for the population. If democracy doesn't mean wealth, and this is what it did mean, I think they did associate, you know, West German standards, Californian standards in 20 years or whatever. If it doesn't produce that, what price democracy? What's the value of democracy?
By August 1998, the Russian economy collapsed. It defaulted on its debts. Many of the banks, perhaps most of them, went under. This economic nightmare was followed by a series of bombs in Moscow apartment buildings in 1999.
The eight-story building was destroyed in the blast, and at least 9 people are dead and 70 injured.
Hundreds were killed, events which led to the Second Chechen War.
The Chechen government has denied any involvement in this, and the two...
For Kathy Lally, the Moscow bombs seemed a useful pretext for Yeltsin and Putin to launch the Second Chechen War.
I remember very clearly going to the first one right after it happened. What astonished me was that it was not a sealed-off crime scene. Within hours, they were bulldozing over the whole site, and how could they possibly have done any serious forensic examination? But it was a useful reason for Russia to again begin hostilities with Chechnya.
On New Year's Eve 1999, Boris Yeltsin surprised everyone with his sudden resignation. He announced that Prime Minister Vladimir Putin would take over as acting president immediately.
No one at all expected it.
Sofia Kishkovsky.
I do remember the phone call I got from the New York Times to tell me what had happened. And I thought she was joking. And I think many people thought it was a joke. There was a lot of what later became, who is Mr. Putin? So this was not what we expected for Yeltsin to hand over power to someone from the KGB.
Kathy Lally.
We had this extraordinary moment with Yeltsin turning over the presidency to Vladimir Putin, giving him the ultimate advantage in the elections that spring for president.
In his final TV broadcast, when he announced his resignation and the handover of power to Putin, Yeltsin begged forgiveness of the Russian people. I want to beg your forgiveness for your dreams that never came true, he said. And I also would like to beg forgiveness for not having justified your hopes. Boris Nemtsov.
He gave power to Putin because of his health. And he used a lot of drugs. That's why in the end of 1999, he was so weak and so sick. And it was his decision to transform power to Putin.
While the 1990s were marked by turmoil, conflict and economic misery, conditions were set up for the emergence of a new national leader, Vladimir Putin, who would restore stability, but who would also roll back on many of the social and political freedoms of the emerging democracy in Russia.
Yeltsin is 100% on the opposite side from Putin. It's even difficult to imagine to appoint a successor who breaks everything you did.
Next on Death of an Empire, the age of Putin and hardline order.
He made a pretty explicit deal with Russians, which was give up some of your freedoms and you'll have order and stability.